Nigel.
Hi. Hi, Charles. Good to see you again.
So what are we doing? What's going on?
We're here today. I should introduce myself.
Oh, yes.
I'm technical evangelist for InfoCard. Mm-hmm. And we're in Aaron's office, Aaron Nanda, who's an architect for InfoCard. He's the main man. He designed mm-hmm. the thing.
And as I said, this is a travesty that we are locked up in this room when the sun is shining bright outside.
Totally.
But anyway.
This is the one day of the year when it's sunny, yeah, and we're inside.
Cool. And we have a developer in the room.
Yeah, this is a real-life developer.
I'm Ruchi. I'm an InfoCard developer. And I'll write the code for everything that Aaron wants to be written.
Excellent.
Ruchi actually owns a vast majority of the code that deals with the remote InfoCard providers that Andy talked about previously, mm-hmm. Where the user is in control on the client system, but when the user chooses to employ an identity in a given application context, and the identity provider happens to be remote, run by, let's say, my employer mm-hmm. or a government agency or whatever, so what do we need to do to go off and talk to those identity providers in order to get the identity information? So that whole, all that code base is handled
nice job.
By Ruchi.
Excellent. So, Nigel, let's...
What are we going to do today? I think we'll spend the first 5 minutes just talking about the basics of InfoCard in case people aren't familiar with it.
Okay.
And then what we're planning to do is go into a little bit about, seeing as we're in an architect's office, we'll talk about the architecture of InfoCard and some of the inside detail about how we've architected the product, how security's built in, mm-hmm. and all that. Interesting detail.
Great.
But we'll set a bit of context first about what InfoCard is and how it works.
Okay. So what's InfoCard? How does it work?
Okay, so time to hit the whiteboard, I guess.
Sure.
Okay. So the first thing to talk about with InfoCard is actually the meta system. So basically the basic problem is that the internet was designed without a layer covering identity. Mm-hmm. Now, the way that TCP was designed, so back in the mid-70s or whatever, the guys that designed TCP/IP, their problem was they had a packet switching network and a satellite network, and they were trying to integrate them together. So the way that they solved that problem was the way you solve all problems in the computing space, which is always add a level of indirection, always add a level of abstraction. So we managed to get different networking stacks talking to each other by having a level of abstraction above that, the internet protocol stack, or TCP/IP as it's more commonly known. Mm-hmm. So the idea with what we're doing with identity and the identity meta system is again to add a level of abstraction across the internet for providing identity that everybody can use. We're trying specifically to be inclusive, to use standards and enable anybody to solve this problem, because it really is a problem. To give you some numbers, Gartner just came out with a survey, and they maintained that of online purchasers, 22% of online purchasers have stopped doing their online purchasing because of fears around security. Mm-hmm. 22%. And a further 25% have reduced the amount of online purchasing that they're doing mm-hmm. because of concerns around security, around phishing, around mm-hmm. malware, and so on and so forth. So basically, we have all this optimism and excitement around Web 2.0 and connected systems and all this, but until we get this basic problem of identity solved, mm-hmm. you know, we're inhibited from fulfilling that. We're even inhibited from just using the internet today. So the way we try and solve that is by using this identity meta system, which is a level above the internet. And the way that we do it is by abstracting the idea of identity. So at its rawest, its most essential, what is identity? Well, identity is a set of claims in a security token. You look at any kind of security system, it's all about security tokens going from A to B to C to D. And you have claims in that token that express properties about a subject. So that might be what my, you know, find the subject, might be my name, might be my domain address, might be my email address, could be my age. The whole point of it being abstract is that these claims can be absolutely anything. But essentially, you have a set of claims within a security token, and then you have three roles within any identity transaction, if you like, that deal with this security token.
Okay.
So at the center, you have me, probably, the subject. We can call the user. And then I'm trying to prove my identity through a set of claims to some entity. This might be a website, it might be a web service, but what we call it is a relying party. We call it a relying party because it relies on an identity being provided. Okay? So I'm trying to access some service or some site by proving some piece of identity about me, some claim. Suppose it's a wine site, I want to buy some wine. I need to provide my name claim. I also need to provide my over 21 claim in the US because you can't drink until you're 21 here. Ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But anyway. So in order to prove that, I need to have some way to provide my identity in a security token.
Mm-hmm.
And the party for doing that is called, naturally enough, an identity provider. So this is the guy that provides a security token containing claims such as that I'm over 21.
Mm-hmm.
So in the case of wine.com, an obvious identity provider would be government or maybe the DOL, you know, the driver licensing authority, because right. They happen to know my age. Or maybe it might be my bank or my school, my employer, could be anybody. But basically, I want to gain access to this site or this service. So the service says, please give me a security token that has these claims in it. So I try and gain access. This guy gives me back some criteria for gaining access.
Mm-hmm.
And then based on that criteria, I can choose one of many identity providers that meet those criteria. I then choose one of them and then give the requirements that the relying party gave me. I needed a token with my age and my name and my address in it.
Mm-hmm.
Send it to this identity provider. He sends me back a security token. And then with that security, I send it back, the token back over here. He cracks open the token. All right, you are over 21. You can go and buy a nice pot of Cabernet Sauvignon.
Okay.
And then everybody's happy. There is one interesting part, which is this identity provider can be something external, like my employer or my government or whatever, but it can also be me, myself, I. The identity provider can be me. So you can actually, I could maintain that I am Nigel Watling. And this is what actually happens when we go to websites today. When we register at a website, be it MySpace or Amazon or you know, Netflix or whatever,
mm-hmm.
what we actually do is we go to some form, we put in our details, we create a password, mm-hmm. and then we register with the site. It's me that's providing that identity. So this identity provider can be external or it can be myself. Now then, with this interaction and this flow, this is very, very abstract.
Mm-hmm.
The way that we drive this interaction is through this thing called InfoCard. So InfoCard is a piece of software which appears on the user's machine when they access a relying party. So I go to a website, it says, tell me who you are. And at that point, the InfoCard dialog pops up, and I have a set of cards that represent my different identities. So one of the identities might be my Microsoft identity. Another identity might be one that I've created myself and I'm on a bulletin board and I'm called Wine Lover or something, or some stupid name that I've thought of.
Mm-hmm.
Another one could be the university I went to or something like that. Basically, a number of different identities suitable for different contexts. So if this relying party is wine.com, an appropriate context would be one of the identities that's able to prove that I'm over 21.
Okay.
So this piece of software on the user's machine, and it could be potentially Macintosh or Linux or any operating system, because all of this is using open protocols. We're very abstract. We don't do anything that can't be used across different platforms. Basically, using this identity selector, I can choose a card, choose an identity that represents a relationship with one of these identity providers, and then go off, get the security token, and then pass that security token onto the website or service that requires my identity. And this identity selector, this piece of software on the user's machine, is what InfoCard is. InfoCard is an identity selector. But this is Microsoft's implementation on Windows.
Now, is that the official name, or is InfoCard?
InfoCard is definitely not the official name, because I understand that it's trademarked by somebody.
Uh-huh.
So even if we wanted to use it, so it is a kind of cool name.
It is.
Even if we wanted to use it, I don't think we are able to. So we in between now and ship time, some clever marketing person has to think of some really catchy name that's better than InfoCard, or...
Well, should have
if we're lucky,
identity in it, or ID maybe, that'd be kind of nice.
If we,
ID makes it very, you know, boring and regimental. I mean, you can always say ID card, but you know, that sounds like we have some bureaucratic organization that's trying to bring something passé of the past to the future.
Okay.
I want something much more catchy than that.
Sure.
Not
okay.
ID card.
All right, marketing people to the rescue.
Yeah. So the experience from a user point of view goes that you go to a website and suppose you log on using username and password. The website can add a button to their login page and says, identify yourself using an info card instead, or using whatever it is we call it. And, you know, it might be called something different on Macintosh, it might be called something different on Linux or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Please identify yourself. You click on the button, up comes the identity selector, you choose the card, off goes a request to the identity provider to get a security token. The security token comes back, you pass it to the website, and you're logged on. All of that without using a username and password. You're just selecting a card, mm-hmm. getting the token, and passing the token across, which is very simple, very intuitive, and it helps in these areas of being phished, and it's the security is pretty good and well locked down, and that's probably what we're going to talk about in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is that the world becomes, or the internet becomes, a safer place for everybody, so we can get onto this cool Web 2.0 stuff.
Okay, great. Well, that's definitely a thorough definition of what we're talking about here.
Did I take half an hour there instead of...
No, you did well. 12 minutes. All right, so...
Okay, so I hand the magic pen to...
All right. So, the piece that we're going to drill into today, uh-huh. I think hopefully it's interesting to a lot of people. It's not interesting from an interoperability standpoint, the stuff we're going to talk about over the next 20 minutes or so,
mm-hmm.
but it's certainly interesting to somebody who might be looking to build an identity selector, for example, on a different platform,
uh-huh.
or just to understand the motivations that went behind designing the architecture the way we did on the client. So we're going to focus on this piece, not talk so much about this, or the interactions here. So what goes on in the identity selector?
Fantastic.
Before I erase this, let me make use of the diagram that Nigel drew to motivate some of the things.
Mm-hmm.
So he's drawn several boxes here representing basically multiple identity providers. In other words, I think of that, if I am the stick man here,
mm-hmm.
then essentially I have relationships with various identity providers, natural relationships by virtue of my interactions with them in daily life. For example, mm-hmm. one of them is my employer. By virtue of being employed, they are in a position to assert certain things about me.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe my government, by being a citizen of US, US government is in a position to assert certain things about me. My bank and so forth. These are all relationships that I have with my identity providers. What I'm looking to do is project assertions or claims about me in these identity relationships mm-hmm. into some other context. That means I want to leverage the relationship that I have with various providers
mm-hmm.
into gaining access to various services that are willing to give me access based on those relationships. So, how do we To talk about this abstractly, how do we represent those relationships?
Mm-hmm.
Well, these little boxes that Nigel drew, this is kind of an artifact that we call a card. And if I were to if I were to take out my wallet,
mm-hmm.
well, each of these things really represents a relationship that I have with the organization that has given me this instrument, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what this is. This is an artifact using which a user can reason about the identity relationships they have with various organizations.
Okay.
It's pretty obvious to the user when they walk up to some service provider, such as a grocery store, and they whip open their wallet, that which of these ones makes sense. And if there are multiple ones that make sense, then the user wants to have control on which one he proffers during that transaction.
Mm-hmm.
So in a grocery store, I may choose amongst my various payment cards in order to make the purchase, right? So it's a metaphor that users are very familiar with, the notion of having some kind of a card that represents some capabilities that an identity provider has in terms of the user, and using it in order to gain access to some service. We're trying to kind of recreate the same metaphor in the digital world, okay? So these cards essentially act like the cards in your wallet. The identity selector surface in which the cards light up is kind of like your wallet that you pull out and say, ah, these are my cards, and let me see which one I want to use. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things which you probably will agree with me is that if you were to arbitrarily find this wallet lying around and you just kind of turn around and say, oh, let me see, is this my wallet? You open it and immediately you'll have a visceral reaction to knowing whether this is your wallet or not.
Yes.
And that's typically based on kind of the cards that you have and the way you have organized it. So at a glance, you kind of get a feel saying, yep, this is my wallet or not, right? And we think that a key to preventing phishing and, you know, kind of bringing that same visceral experience into the digital world is to provide a surface on which the user can have such a predictable experience of seeing these cards in the same way, same organization, and so forth. That means the cards in and of themselves, in a way, act as a personalization of the experience that the user has. So if we can prevent somebody else from spoofing that same experience, that is, from producing the same set of cards organized the same way, then I think we have gone a long way in terms of personalizing, you know, having the user believe that they are in a very personalized wallet-like experience. So I just wanted to give that as a motivation.
Great. Well, it also begs the question then, since you used the wallet metaphor, someone can steal your wallet.
Yes.
Somebody can steal your credit cards.
Yep.
So if I get some malware on my machine via some other application that I'm surfing the internet, because InfoCard is only going to protect me when I use InfoCard.
Correct.
So if malware gets onto my machine and steals my card files, because these are files, what does that mean if it sends them up to some server and then, do they steal my identity then?
Great question. We hope not. So you've asked the leading question, using which we can now segue into really drilling into the architecture essentially. But before I do that, I just want to, since you raised the question, I don't want to defer it. So let's just answer that briefly now, and we'll talk about the actually architecture by which we protect the cards later on. So the thing that I want to emphasize right now is that these cards, these little boxes that we have drawn here, in and of themselves, they're not identities. That means the cards themselves are not what a relying party accepts in order to gain, give you access to the service. The cards are essentially buckets of metadata, interesting metadata, using which the user can visualize that identity, and they contain sufficient information for them to light up in response to a relying party's requirement, and they contain sufficient information for the client agent to go and contact the appropriate identity provider and get the security token that you would give to the relying party. In other words, what I'm saying is, if I left this card lying around on a park bench and somebody picked it up, essentially it's no good because it's just a bucket of metadata. So in order to employ that card, I have to go back to the backing identity provider and prove to the identity provider who I am, which we call authentication, which is standard terminology, and then be able to get the security token that I can give to the relying party. Okay. So if I picked up one of these cards that belong to you, Charles, then in order to really use it at a relying party, I have to be able to prove to your identity provider that I am Charles. And hopefully that authentication is secure. It's based on something. As I said, these are all based on relationships I have, so which means that the identity provider, namely your bank or your employer, has given you something based on which you can prove who you are. In employer case, typically you have an Active Directory-based account and a password. Using Kerberos, you can prove who you are, and therefore you can get the security token that you need. Or they may have issued you a smart card that you carry around. Anytime you want to get a security token from your employer that you want to give somewhere else, well, you'll have to insert your smart card and type in the PIN in order to authenticate yourself. So unless I can get hold of the card and the corresponding credential based on which I can go and authenticate to the identity provider, you don't actually steal the identity. So that's a very crucial point, because the actual interesting data, all the crypto material, all the claims, the claim values and all that, the personal information, that's all protected in the data center behind the identity provider. Mm. None of that exists on the client machine. And therefore, it is, we believe, that it makes the client kind of a less interesting thing to attack.
Interesting.
Right.
Okay.
So, should we just move into the what this client piece looks like?
Absolutely.
And what the architecture is? I'm going to erase this.
Sure.
That was limited real estate.
I think everyone's probably clear now what's going on.
Okay, I'm going to use a, I don't know which color shows up well on
let's see.
On video. Green, blue?
Blue, the darker is probably better. Blue, black, blue.
Okay, so let's just go with blue then.
Okay.
So, since I alluded to the term wallet, well, let's just call it a card store. So what we have here on a machine, and we are talking about, so everything I want to talk about is centered on the client machine, essentially. So I, as a user, I'm sitting in front of a computer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm using that as a vehicle to gain access to some remote service. So I'm talking about the computer that I'm sitting on.
Okay.
So at the bottom of that, there is some kind of a, there is a card store, which is a collection of those little squares that Nigel had drawn, the artifacts that we call cards, or info cards, or whatever the cool name of that is going to be. So it's a collection of cards. The vehicles, the agent through which I gain access, that I, you know, through which I usually want to access some kind of a service,
mm-hmm.
It can be, the one which most people are familiar with is a browser, because that is a common application using which you gain access to web sites and
certain
services. In our case, it'll be Internet Explorer, and we'll just talk about 7.0, because the enabling of the browser to use info cards is happening at the for IE 7, version 7.
Okay.
So that's one possible application that could make use of the info card experience in order to allow the user to proffer his identity. The other type of application is a Windows Communication Foundation-based application, which we've also referred to as like an Indigo application, Indigo
yep.
being the code name for WCF. Sometimes you might hear the term rich clients, you know, mm-hmm. as distinct from browsers.
Or smart client or fat client.
Or smart clients or a fat client, exactly. So all those imply, I mean, this box implies all those terminologies.
Certainly.
The third, not so interesting, but not really in a general purpose application, but rather in order to allow the user to manage these things that are there,
mm-hmm.
You can think of a simple control panel applet that we have exposed, which essentially is going to allow the user to, you know, manage these identities. So this covers the broadest range of smart clients. I mean, that's that bucket.
Mm-hmm.
This essentially is a generic application through which you can access various sites. This
okay.
is a very dedicated application that essentially allows these things to be managed, okay?
Okay.
So these are the constituencies from which that may have an interest in accessing these cards.
Just to interject here, those are the three Microsoft cases, but also you could use a different browser, get
yeah.
exactly the same experience, and also you could use a different... is it smart client or rich client? Smart client. You can use a different. All you really need is a WS star stack.
Mm-hmm.
So on Windows, the logical thing to use is WCF.
Mm-hmm.
But if you could use any WS star stack that understood, was it WS Trust, WS Security, WS Security Policy, WS Metadata Exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're not constrained to WCF. It's just that. That's what we tend to talk about a lot because those are the bits we use.
Sure.
Excellent point, Nigel. So let me augment this picture to say this can be any browser. This can be any WS aware app. I'm scribbling. I don't think this is going to show very well.
No, that's fine. We hear you clearly.
Okay.
So the W star.
WS-star
protocol stuff.
Right. Okay.
And that's a CPL file that's specific to Windows.
Correct.
So you have to write your own.
Right.
All right.
So, since we said that, you know, as I said, I kind of used the wallet metaphor saying if you found somebody's wallet and you just picked it up, you will instinctively know whether it's yours or not. Mm-hmm. And the stuff that's in the wallet is really the collection out here. Okay. So what we really want to create is a gate by which access to these things is controlled and mediated, right? Mm-hmm. And this is, architecturally, this is the function of the thing that we call the InfoCard service. So this is a kind of a privileged service that runs on the client machine, mm-hmm. which acts as the gatekeeper of the content of this and mediates access from any of these things down here. So once we have the service, essentially, obviously, it must expose an interface. So all these things are going to call into this. Now, for each of these things, each of these constituencies to call the InfoCard service, we've got some helper code that runs in these things. So for the Internet Explorer case, for example, we have something called as, I believe it's called iCard, IE.dll. All right?
Okay.
It's a piece of helper code that allows a site to express the need for InfoCard using a standard browser extensibility mechanism. More specifically, they can embed an ActiveX control or a binary behavior object, which are both understood by this DLL, essentially.
Okay.
And what this does, in turn, calling into this, is invokes a function that's called getBrowserToken. Simple API.
Okay.
In the case of a Indigo-enabled app or WCF app, mm-hmm. there is library, and maybe Ruchi can help me. I think there's a particular object model here, which is system dot identity model dot selectors. Okay.
Okay.
That's basically one of the kind of strongly typed namespace classes that's available as part of WCF for applications to use. Mm-hmm. And this, on the back end, essentially calls into the InfoCard service using a simple API called getToken.
Now, clearly, I mean, most people in the audience understand that WCF has a managed interface,
right?
But you don't have to write managed code, right?
In order to use InfoCard, for example, the browser is a good example. You don't have to. You don't have to. Correct.
Fantastic. Just wanted to point that out.
Yes.
Yeah, even for an app, the getToken functionality is both available in native as well as managed code, so you can use both versions.
So what's the native DLL? If somebody wanted to call it natively, what would they need to do?
It's called iCardAgent.dll, but it's the same. We have a getToken functionality just the way we have a getToken functionality on for the managed case.
Okay. I just wanted to throw that out.
Yeah, so that's a good clarification to make. And this one, the control panel applet, essentially, we don't want the applet itself to be doing the management of the cards in the application. What we really wanted is a way to invoke the management experience that's built into the InfoCard system. So this invokes a simple API called manage. That's it. You say, okay, I just want to manage something, manage my cards. And then the real meat of the application to manage your cards is inside the service.
Okay.
Now, another piece that I'm going to draw here, the interesting thing here is that if you can think of this InfoCard service as logical, so this is a service boundary. This InfoCard service, as I said, runs as a privileged service, and in those familiar with the Windows system, mm-hmm. this actually runs as local system. Mm-hmm. Okay. Logically, it consists of two parts in there. One is, I think what Nigel already alluded to this, is functionally what's called as the identity selector. Okay?
Okay.
And the other is what I would call as the store abstraction.
Okay.
Each of these pieces makes use of other security capabilities and stack capabilities in Windows. For example, the store abstraction makes use of something called as DPAPI, which is Data Protection API, which is a way, it's a secure way of protecting some piece of data that is encrypted and then tied to a key that's only available for that particular user. So when the user is interactively logged on, can you go and unlock that key and then crack open the pieces of data? So that's kind of one of the Windows capabilities that the store layer makes use of.
Okay.
The identity selector, similarly, is going to make use of WCF itself in order to talk to the identity providers at the other end, right? It also makes use of things like the certificate API, the application interface, in order to deal with service identities and so forth presented to it in the form of X509 certificates.
Hmm.
So these are things that it makes use of.
I think these are things that any application developer can use. I mean,
yeah, these are
somebody watching could easily go onto MSDN and look up DeepHappy, DeepHappy.
In other words, they're not their Windows components.
It's just standard APIs that you can use as an application developer.
Standard Windows
yeah.
APIs.
Yeah, exactly.
Correct. Right. Now, there's an important piece here, which is if this service is running as local system, and we have said that the user needs to be in control of offering their identity, that means the user needs to see something, which means that the service needs to be able to show some UI to the user, hopefully on a secure surface that is not scrapable.
Okay.
And so that somebody cannot come and spoof that experience, essentially. Or as things are going, so for example, if I have an application running on a user's desktop, you can certainly have some other piece of code that sends a message to that window and be able to, take a peek at what's going into the window and not what's on the window surface, right? So we want to avoid those kind of things. So what we really want is the ability for this this local system process to be able to throw some UI on a secure surface that the user can see and deal with in the context of an application.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to enable that to occur, we have this other process, which is called the UI agent process. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
The relationship is that whereas this service is system-wide, which means there's only one such service running on the PC at any time, the agent process is created on demand by this process.
Okay.
In the user's desktop, in the user's logon session. Okay. However, the difference is that this agent process creates a separate desktop, which is strongly ACKER, so that only this service can actually send messages and display something on that.
Uh-huh.
So if you have seen the InfoCard, I don't know if you have seen the InfoCard demo in one of these.
I have.
Okay. So, you'll see that when you go to a service and essentially when you say, use the InfoCard, what will happen is the background will fade and suddenly the InfoCard, the InfoCard dialog will appear. Essentially what you're seeing there is a snapshot of the user's desktop taken and faded into the background to preserve context. That is, the user knows in what context he's dealing with his InfoCard subsystem.
It's just a bitmap, right?
It's just a bitmap. And then the InfoCard dialog that shows up actually is running on a separate private desktop.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody can send any messages to it or collect things from it. No other application running on the user's regular desktop can send any messages to it and collect information from it.
But now, could I write an application that does the same thing?
Sure.
And fool users?
Absolutely.
But of course, the question is, when I'm fooling them, nothing happens.
Well,
right.
The question is, when you're fooling them, essentially, you also have to be able to manifest the set of cards that are here into that surface. So just because you can, you're right, creating a private desktop is a standard Windows functionality. It's not that, it's not that interesting in the sense that most applications don't want to use it because they don't want to have to go to the trouble of creating a separate desktop for nothing.
Sure.
But you're right. If somebody is really trying to steal your identity, they could attempt to do that, but then, as I said, if I pull up my wallet and I don't see anything in it, or I don't see the cards that I'm familiar, then that wallet is useless. So drawing a private desktop is equivalent to kind of getting somebody's wallet, but if it doesn't have the right type of stuff in it that I can recognize, then essentially I'm going to be suspicious of the contents of
that
wallet. So there's an interface between this. And this essentially runs, what this UI agent does is it materializes a kind of a protected desktop, a private desktop.
Okay.
And this is where the InfoCard UI surfaces, essentially.
Okay. So that's not the secure desktop.
So Nigel brings up an interesting point. There is the notion of a secure desktop, which is on Windows when you press the Control Alt and Del key simultaneously, mm-hmm. called the secure attention sequence, you kind of get a separate desktop on which you can enter your username password.
Yep.
Right. This is not that desktop, but it has all the characteristics of that desktop. So it's essentially similar to the secure desktop.
It's very similar in the case that you cannot, once you're on that desktop, you cannot access your desktop that you were working on.
Understood.
You have to get out of this.
It's a modal. Yeah, totally understand.
It's a modal. So if InfoCard hangs while you're in that desktop?
Pretty bad, so we shouldn't make anything that hang InfoCard.
Yes.
Well, that's the challenge of our, you know, testing and the stress and the self-hosting is that you try to ensure that there is a way by which you can recover in any of the, or hopefully you don't hang in any of those cases.
Sure, but I could always use Control-Alt-Delete.
That would never happen.
No.
But you could get out of that, you could do Control-Alt-Delete and get out of that desktop, couldn't you? Run task manager.
Yes.
Sure.
Yes.
All right.
Okay. So I already talked about the need for, and why do we need this separate agent process? As I said, this agent process, in order to show UI, the process needs to be part of the user's logon session.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, since this service is kind of machine-wide and it runs in local system, it doesn't really have any particular logon session attached to it, we create this process and make it part of the user's logon session so mm-hmm. that it is capable of displaying UI to the user. Mm-hmm. And additionally, it displays UI on a protected desktop that's specially ACURL so that only, you know, indirectly, only the InfoCard service can then surface UI and nothing else can.
Now, what was the architectural reason for making this local system and not just have it be bound to a user's logon as a system?
Right. So the idea is that when the cards are stored locally on mm-hmm. disk, essentially these are strongly ACL so that only system has access to them, right? So that's one reason, but one may argue that, well, if system has access, how can you ensure that that the is in the loop as well? That system can't unilaterally just use these identities. Well, that's a valid argument. Mm-hmm. So we want system to act as a security gate, but we also want to ensure that the user contributes something in order to unlock this card store. So what we have done is a clever thing. I said we make use of DP API, so we mm-hmm. take the card store, essentially encrypt this, so this is encrypted, but really it's encrypted at two levels. It's encrypted with a DP API key that terminates in the system as an entity,
okay,
and it's again doubly or repeat iteratively encrypted with DP API that terminates with the user acting as a root. So in other words, it really, in order to crack this thing open, you have to have both of these entities present. So in other words, a user application trying to directly access this
mm-hmm.
cannot unlock it, firstly because it's ACL to system, and secondly it can't quite open it because it can only do one level of decryption. And similarly, something running in the system context essentially cannot directly crack it open either because it needs the DP API key that comes from the user's DP API root, and which means the user must actually be present to unlock that DP API root. So they must be signed on.
The user has to be logged on in order to have that. It has to have an active session.
Yeah.
Cool. It's double encryption.
So all this security, of course, I'll ask the obvious question, which is, what happens if I, say, forget my password, or what happens if some way I can no longer log in and I no longer have access to these cards? What happens then? Or what happens if I change my password? That's another question as well.
If you change your password, DP API will take care of, the way DP API works, it will take care of the fact that you can still use your new password and be able to log in. But the store will not work in the case where the password has been reset, because that's a special case. But in case of password change, DP API takes care of it.
So if I had to go to an administrator and say, I've forgotten my password, please reset my password, then I wouldn't have any access to my info cards. But if I changed it myself, that would be fine.
Yes, Yes.
Interesting.
But so we have mechanisms by which you can take the card store, and you could have backups. You may have exported that for the purpose of moving into another machine. Mm-hmm. So any of those copies that you have of the card store essentially is a good starting point to recover the set of cards, essentially. So actually, yeah, we didn't cover the roaming aspect, which is, are these cards really locked to my machine? Well, you know, hopefully not. So what we have done in the initial version of the product implementation is that we provide a mechanism by which the collection of cards, essentially, I'm going to do it in a second. The collection of cards, this stuff, through an user experience can be exported, and the exported collection essentially is encrypted. So this is an encrypted file, essentially protected by a PKCS 5 derived key from a passphrase. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Is it worth explaining what PKCS 5?
Well, it's a standard method to take some piece of string like a password or a passphrase and derive a strong key out of that. Essentially, okay. The idea is that when this collection of cards has been exported onto some media, and you get hold of that media, then hopefully you cannot do much with it, right? Mm-hmm. Because it has sufficient encryption strength and security around it in order to prevent somebody from cracking it open. It's the same as saying, if I have stored some files on my disk which is encrypted, right? If the encryption strength is strong enough, then hopefully nobody else can have access to that file.
Okay, so then, so why couldn't this be located on a remote server? Why does it have to be physical medium?
Fantastic question. So I'm telling you what we are doing in the version 1,
okay.
Which is I can take this card collection, export them onto an external media, and then take it to another machine and do the reverse of that, which is import it. Mm-hmm. So if you pretend this is now a different machine,
sure.
I can go and populate this thing back here. Okay?
Okay.
So which means that the identity selector as a component running on the machine is always interacting with this local card store. Right?
Okay.
But you asked a very good question, is that why does it have to be that way? And the answer is it doesn't have to be. And that's, so in order to make our roaming story kind of more convenient and a stronger story,
mm-hmm.
what we are also looking to do, and the factoring here actually makes that possible, is that if we can essentially formalize the interface between the identity selector and the store abstraction with the backing store,
mm-hmm.
if this is formalized in a nice way, oops. Then essentially it doesn't matter if this piece exists locally or it exists remotely on some kind of a cloud service or it exists remotely on a device, mm-hmm. such as a cell phone or a smart dongle of the USB form factor, right? And that's exactly what we would like to do.
Cool.
Is to be able to, and you may hear the terminology that this thing referred to as a portable SDS or a PSTS. The idea is I can take my collection of cards along with the self-issued varieties where there is an SDS. I think you talked about an SDS before.
Yeah, we probably need to take a slight step back and talk about when the identity provider is external, like a government or an employer, and the user case. So when the user is the identity provider, of mm-hmm. course, it's not only the cards that are stored locally, but also the information associated with those cards, because the identity provider is the user, and the identity provider's machine is the client machine in front of them.
Uh-huh.
So in that instance, the thing that the identity provider has that issues tokens mm-hmm. is naturally enough called a security token service. So I send a request for a security mm-hmm. token, security token service processes that request, authenticates me, and then sends back a security token. Now, if I'm the identity provider, if I'm the user of the identity provider, that means that I also need to have a security token service on my local machine. So when I choose a card that represents a self-issued identity, mm-hmm. that actually, again, has a request for a security token, but in this case, it's the local info card system that handles that request, creates the token associated with that self-issued card and posts the token or sends the token off to the relying party. So InfoCard on the client actually has a couple of things associated with it. It's purely this identity selector piece, mm-hmm. where I'm choosing a card that represents a relationship with an identity provider. Mm-hmm. But there's also the case where I am the identity provider. In that case, I have a local security token service that deals with those requests and provides security tokens for the user. So that's the area I think we're going to get into now. The card store is not just the cards. Yeah. It's also this very specific when the user is the identity mm-hmm. provider case where we have this local information.
And is that a result of what you've done? Is that your area?
Yes, some of it. So what we need there is one more box, really, which is a part of the InfoCard service. Yeah. Let's see. So what we need is we have an identity selector, a store abstraction, and also a self-issued STS. That's what we could call it. And so when we use a self-issued identity, what mm-hmm. happens is we pick up a card from the store, mm-hmm. and instead of sending it to an external STS, we would just use this STS to create a token, because all that is a token service which creates a token, as Nigel had spoken before, with a set of claims that we can assert about ourselves.
Okay.
So that's all that is.
So, yeah,
cool.
Just to just paraphrase that, we have essentially packaged a simple identity provider as part of the InfoCard system into the client, using which the user can self-assert some information about themselves.
So and it's probably important to emphasize that it's a fixed set of claims.
Yes.
There's 12 claims in total, and then 11 of them are editable in the UI for InfoCard. And there's nothing really confidential there. Like, you can't extend it and add your social security number or anything like that. It's just things like your first name, your last name, your address, your gender. Very, very basic information.
These are things that most people can obtain, glean from public records about you anyways. Mm-hmm. And the whole reason is that we don't want to make that kind of a honeypot of, you know, a swarm of hackers and attackers trying to kind of converge on that and say, oh, we've got all kinds of cool data about people mm-hmm. sitting on their machine, and so we can extract it. Because the idea is that you really want some of the sensitive information about you that could be used to somebody's advantage, mm-hmm. you know, in some real meaningful and risky fashion, mm-hmm. to be protected behind the data centers of identity providers that can invest, that can make the right types of investments in order to guard that information.
Understood.
And your PC, certainly you're not making that kind of investment to guard the information. So it makes sense to only have a very small set of data there, which is convenient and satisfies a lot of your browsing and, you know, general casual visits to website kind of requirements. Mm-hmm. But anytime you want to use a high-value transaction, you probably want to go to a bona fide identity provider and get the sensitive information.
And so now, if what happens in the case where an identity provider service gets hacked, taken over? Nothing. I mean, so in other words, I'm shooting my tokens up to something that can just take my tokens. But if it's been hacked, what does that mean?
Well, that's the same as saying what happens if somebody hacks into the Microsoft corporate network and gains control of the AD.
Okay.
We're all screwed, right?
Yeah. But that's too bad.
But the place for this sensitive identity information is in some companies or some entities' IT. IT center. It's not on the user's machine.
Yeah.
So basically, yes, hackers can hack their way into the InfoCard system, spend, you know, many, many man years unraveling it all. And when they finally get there, they'll find that the information there is not very interesting, and they should have just spent 5 minutes looking it up in a phone book. Because the interesting information is stored remotely in my employer's STS or in my government's STS or whatever, my bank's STS.
Understood.
And in order to gain access to that, the hacker would need to get my credentials for authenticating to that service.
Sure. And I mean, that brings up the good point, because by storing them in a secure remote location, a user can't make a bad decision.
Correct.
Can't True. Make a mistake, can't let something in or on their system.
Right.
Right.
The only decision they're making is about whether to employ that identity or not, but really none of their decisions goes to undermine the security of the identity information that's protected by the identity provider.
Cool. Well, we have about 10 minutes left of tape, so
okay.
Where shall we go next?
So this was a good segue, and okay. So this is part of our kind of follow-up release is to allow this capability, namely allow a user to place their identity collection, mm-hmm. including this self-issued identity provider, onto a device so that they can walk up to any machine, essentially, plug the device, use the identities off of that machine, essentially using the PC just as a conduit to access a service.
Mm-hmm.
And so the identities never really move on to the PC. And when they're done, they unplug and then they walk off. So it's truly portable. The crucial cryptographic key materials are never released from the device onto the PC. Therefore, they're never available to code running on the PC to hack. And so it raises the bar to a much higher level in order to really protect your identities.
Fantastic.
Okay. What else is interesting that you, let me ask?
You've spoken about the roaming store.
So what about the way you implemented it? You wrote it in C++? Is that where you spend most of your time?
Oh,
this is a mix. We've got some of our, a lot of our UI is written in C++, mm-hmm. Whereas most of our service is a mix of managed and native code. So we are a mixed mode assembly.
Because usually it's the other way around, right? I'm going to write my UI in managed code, and then I'm going to do C++.
Why did you choose to write it in unmanaged code?
a lot of it had to do with the fact that we are using WCF and the capabilities that WCF provides, and so we have to be a managed service. So.
Yeah, but well, why was the... I assume that with the UI, most of it's unmanaged because you're in a protected desktop,
yes.
I assume.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, too bad, I mean, no, I don't mean it that way. I mean, if you could have probably been a more pleasant experience writing the UI in C# or...
It would be easier, yes.
Yes, that's what I mean.
But I guess security is a little more important. So.
It is? Yeah, of course it is. All right, cool. I just wanted to know. I mean,
how much is written in managed code, do you think, of the whole system?
Right now, I would say about 40% is managed code. There is 60% of everything is native.
And probably...
It might become more...
If it wasn't for those security constraints, it would probably be a lot more managed code, I guess.
Yes.
Let's talk about that for a second, because that's sort of hand-waving in the sense of why... What do you mean, security constraints and not in writing managed code? Why is that an issue? And just made it in your decision, security... Can you explain it? I think people will be confused. So you're saying that you're using an unsafe language to be more secure. So, anyway, can you explain why... you need a C++ because you can't interoperate with the protected desktop and managed code? That's all I'm asking.
It had to do a lot with our design decisions. Initially, mm-hmm. the idea was that we are really going to be all native, uh-huh. right? So that was the idea.
There's a history behind this.
Sure.
One of the data points leading up to that history was that we certainly wanted this functionality to go down level.
Okay.
And the other thing was that we also wanted to take a minimum dependency on the availability of certain pieces of code on the down level, essentially. So employing, particularly when we go to XP and so forth, right?
Mm-hmm.
Employing the standard Win32 mechanisms already provided to Surface UI seemed like a safe bet to make.
Sure,
that's always available essentially, and it allows for this interaction essentially to be completely under control with no other dependencies that we have to take. Internal dependencies.
So, in the case where you have a client that's not running the framework. Well, you have to run it. You have to install WinFX to do any of this stuff.
Right.
Right? So you're going to have the client. Anyway, I don't mean to rat hole on this.
No,
those are
fair questions, and that's the reason why, the info card, if you think about the info card functionality as such, it could actually exist outside of the Windows Communication Foundation
right.
and the WinFX. It's an happenstance. It's a design choice as to how we chose to integrate that into the application framework.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that that's done today doesn't mean that it needs to stay limited to the...
Yeah, as we pointed out earlier,
sure.
you just need a WS star stack.
Uh-huh.
And seeing as there's a a group in Microsoft building a very good WS star stack called WCF.
Okay.
It kind of reduces the amount of work that the InfoCard team does to leverage their work, right?
Yes, so. But I mean, since this is our creation, is there thought to invest some man hours and woman hours, excuse me,
person hours,
to build cross-platform? I mean, why don't we build one for the Mac?
Fantastic question. And we might actually take on some of those thought processes.
Okay. Excellent answer.
It's an important point because it's really important that we get cross-platform adoption. Mm-hmm. So, you know, all of this stuff that we're doing is open, and we absolutely want this to be supported on other platforms. So if people want to, if other vendors want to talk to us, then our door is open, and we will help anybody and everybody who's interested.
Cool. We'll talk to anyone who's interested.
Yeah,
the higher order bit really is that, you know, I think Nigel outlined this at the outset, is that we really want to plug the gap of this missing identity layer for the internet. And, you know, as we said, the identity metasystem is a concept that tries to bring that identity layer into the internet experience, the distributed applications. I mean, not distributed, but, you know, the internet, essentially the way we know it. And InfoCard is an implementation that we have done, but really for this thing to gain traction all the way across, we really want the identity metasystem to germinate and all, you know, to actually take roots in all the platforms, essentially. If our implementation of this thing on Windows is useful and makes sense for somebody else, I mean, at least some of the design decisions make sense, certainly we're willing to, you know, share and talk about this so that all platforms essentially can participate in the identity metasystem message and truly identity-enable the internet so that the user is the ultimate beneficiary.
Fantastic. Beautiful stuff.
Just one thing I probably want to touch on, which may confuse people, is we talk a lot about using WS Star as the enabling technology. So does this mean that if I have a website today that I need to WS Star enable that website?
Great question. No, so you wanted the barrier to entry to be as low as possible, but yet, you know, not completely compromise on the goals that we had. So a site, you know, like maybe we should spend 5 minutes on that.
We have 2 minutes and 30 seconds, so we can do it.
Let's just speak to that. So a site essentially could embrace InfoCard with minimal change to their already deployed front ends. So the web servers that are already deployed that actually serve out some function or content to users can essentially remain unchanged. And if the sites can essentially bolt on what's known as this STS security token service, which is an added server, then they can actually get the secure InfoCard-based interaction. But that's if they want to get the higher level of functionality. They could even, without bolting on an STS, if they can switch over to a mode where instead of querying passwords, they can accept these tokens, security tokens, to be posted directly up to the site, and they just crack it open and ensure that it is authentic and that it represents the user that's allowed access to the site.
So in other words, a website just needs to modify their login page.
They need to only modify the login page.
And that's it. They hand out the cookie as usual, and they're done. So modify the login page, hand out the cookie. It's the same as ever. So instead of using a username and password, you just choose a card. And the website doesn't have to do very much at all, really.
Right.
Cool. I've seen the demo on Kim's weblog.
Yep. That's a good demo. Yeah. So the idea of using the cookie mechanism is that the vast majority of the deployed front ends essentially continue to base their access decisions on the cookie that flows. Mm-hmm. So it's only the point of origin of the cookie, which is typically the login page, which decides whether to write the cookie on the client or not. That's the only page that needs to change its processing behavior, which says, instead of processing a password to verify who the user is, I'm going to now process this new type of token and determine whether the user is good or not. Once I have made that determination, I post the cookie and the rest of the site remains unaffected.
And of course, all this is happening over a secure channel.
Yes.
All right. Well, you guys, this has been fantastic.
My pleasure.
I think people really have a good idea of what's going on.
Our pleasure.
We'll continue to talk. I would love to see how this evolves.
Okay.
And, you know, excellent. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome.